The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week... Yes, that was the sound of the universe. I'll be meeting astrobiologist Lewis Dartnell to hear why space is not as silent as you think. And...
My thoughts, my movements, everything about me is contained in this lump of tissue that has a consistency of jelly.
Here in the studio is The Guardian's new brains blogger, Mo Costandi. He'll be taking us on a tour of his mind and giving us a peek at some of the frontiers of neuroscience. We'll also go through some of the latest results from CERN with implications for climate models and the worrying abuse that some scientists get just for doing their work. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. The 21st century is going to be all about the brain. At least that's what neuroscientists will tell you. At The Guardian, we don't disagree with that sentiment, so we thought it'd be opportune to get someone on board who could shine a torch into the complex and mysterious area of the mind. Mo Costandi is the man behind our superb new neuroscience blog, Neurophilosophy. He's studied molecular and developmental neurobiology and is now mainly a science writer who's dedicated to expanding the popular understanding of our brain and how it works. Mo, welcome to Science Weekly. Can you just take us through how neurophilosophy was born?
Actually, Alok, I was working as a security guard. I left a PhD that I was doing at the MRC Centre for Developmental Neurobiology, and I ended up working as a security guard. I was doing very long shifts and I had very little work to do, and I'd always enjoyed writing and was very interested in neuroscience. I'd heard about these blog things. This was back in 2005. So I decided to set one up and write about neuroscience.
I mean, since 2005, the blog's gone through various modes. It was on science blogs for a while. You started with us in The Guardian just under a month ago. Tell us what it is about the brain that you find interesting.
It's this lump of jelly in my head that makes me who I am. It controls my thoughts, my movements. Everything about me is contained in this lump of tissue that has a consistency of jelly. I'm fascinated by how this piece of jelly can do all the things it does.
Now, I said in the intro that the 21st century was going to be the century of the brain. I know that you probably think that. So explain to our listeners why this century is going to be so exciting in this area.
Well, I think because we still know next to nothing about the brain and how it works. And now we're beginning to develop technologies. So we have some quite advanced technologies at our disposal to really begin to gain some real understanding of how the brain works.
So what kinds of things are we talking about?
We hear a lot about brain size and its relationship to intelligence, but actually what's probably more important is connectivity and the complexity of the connections between brain cells. And the human brain probably contains something like a trillion synapses, connections, but it's a highly dynamic organ. Everything we do, every experience we have changes the physical structure of the brain. It actually reorganizes these synapses.
So you're talking there about how an everyday experience, say for example a thought, a memory, an emotion, an action, trauma, whatever, can actually change the wiring of the brain, and the wiring of the brain is changing itself around all the time. That's the connectome you're talking about, this connection, all the connections. And this is the sort of the frontier of the neuroscience being researched right now.
It's one of them. But as I said, I think understanding how the things we do alter the connections in the brain will be one way of gaining a better understanding of how this thing works.
So can you give me an example of that? How does something that we do change the wiring of the brain?
Well, for example, if we meet a new person for the first time, what we think might be happening is that new cells are actually being generated in a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is essential for forming memories. So new cells are being formed and they're forming new connections, and these new cells and the connections they form are probably very important in encoding memories of this new person that you've met.
And what was the traditional view of how the brain worked 100 years ago? I mean, it's changed a lot since then. And this idea that you're talking about now, this plasticity, essentially, it's quite a new concept. So what was it like 100 years ago, or when, well, maybe not 100 years ago, but when we were discovering that neurons made connections and things? It's a very different idea we have now to sort of at least 50 years ago.
Well, I think probably the biggest advance in our understanding of the brain is that it's actually composed of cells, like every other organ in the body. There was an argument that went on for most of the 19th century about whether or not the brain was actually composed of cells, and researchers only actually figured out that it does consist of cells just over 100 years ago. And perhaps the next major discovery is this idea that the brain is very dynamic. It can actually generate new cells, and the connections can change with experience. But as I said, we still know very, very little about the brain. For example, just 50 years ago, 60 years ago, when Hodgkin and Huxley performed their classical experiments on the giant squid axon to characterize the nervous impulse and how the nervous impulse is produced. Since those experiments, we thought we'd figured out how brain cells work. We thought they work as binary switches. They're either on or off. But of course, in recent years, it's emerged that even a single cell is far more complicated. So this is just at the cellular level. We still do not understand how an individual neuron functions.
Tell us then what you think we will be able to understand. We've outlined some challenges, of course, and there are lots of scientific challenges there. But for us, in us understanding our brains and working out how they control us, the things that you were interested in right from the beginning, what light are we going to get onto things like consciousness or perception or emotions, that kind of thing, the things that people care about?
Something I find very interesting is what's called embodied cognition. And this is the idea that our bodies, that the sensations and we receive from our bodies and bodily movements can actually influence the way we think and behave. For example, if you're reading a book, you'll think of the ideas in the book as being more serious if the book is heavy. And if you let your mind wander, your movements can actually influence what you think about. So if you perform a backwards movement, you're more likely to think about something that happened in the past. Whereas if you perform a forwards movement, you're more likely to contemplate the future. And there's another recent study where participants were shown pictures of androgynous faces and asked to characterize them as being either male or female. And they were more likely to judge them as male if they were feeling something with a rough texture, and more likely to judge them as female if they were feeling something with a smooth texture. And the body is also a critical component of our sense of self-identity. Philosophers have known about this for hundreds of years. Hume, for example, said that when he thinks of himself, it's always in reference to some sensation that he's feeling from his body or some action that he's performing. And neuroscience is actually beginning to catch up now, and it's showing us that our sense of self is very firmly grounded in the body.
So what are you looking at for your blog next?
Well, I was thinking about writing something about epigenetics and how, for example, pregnant women who evacuated the Twin Towers have transmitted their traumatic experiences onto their children.
Okay, well, don't give away the ending. But of course, if you want to read that story at some point soon on Mo's blog, go to guardian.co.uk/science/neurophilosophy. Thanks, Mo.
Thanks very much, Alok.
We're going to take a look at this week's science news now. With me is The Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample and The Observer's science and tech editor Robin McKee. Ian, let's start with you. This is some latest results from CERN, but weirdly, it's to do with climate change.
Right, so this is a project at CERN called CLOUD. Now, essentially, what the project is doing is it's an extremely clean chamber, which you can use to simulate how clouds form in the atmosphere. Now, the reason that the project was set up was specifically to answer this question as to whether, if at all, cosmic rays from deep space, basically these come from exploding stars in the Milky Way, whether those rays can influence how little particles called aerosols are created and grow in the atmosphere. And we know that these aerosol particles ultimately can seed clouds. They become substrates for cloud droplets to grow on, and that's how clouds form. Now, the results that came out were really interesting. I mean, actually, the main result was not so much to do with the cosmic rays. And I'll talk about why they're interesting and why they're contentious a bit in a minute. But the main result that came out was, if you look at what's called the boundary layer of the atmosphere, this is a fairly low down altitude of the atmosphere. A lot of climate models that model the sort of creation of these aerosols assume that these little particles form when sulfuric acid and water and ammonia get together, and you end up with these particles forming. Now, you can get aerosols forming in the atmosphere. You can also get them just kicked up from the planet. So you can get them as dust and sand and water spray from the sea.
Just to be clear, before anyone thinks aerosols are things you come out of cans.
Right,
the
sure,
ozone layer.
Sure.
Aerosols are simply very, very, very tiny particles.
Yeah, it's a generic word for small liquid or solid particles that just are suspended in the atmosphere. Now, I was talking about the main result from the paper, and what it found was that people thought, say, these three components made aerosols naturally, water, sulfuric acid, and ammonia. But when you do that in this experiment, you get something like between a tenth and a thousandth of the amount of aerosol you would expect. So what they're saying is that there are some other, and in this case, it has to be organic gases, gases that are playing into this process. Now, that might seem incredibly sort of esoteric, but what it means is that there are vapors coming off that are going into the atmosphere, whether they are from human activity or just from natural processes, by it being animals or plants, that are crucial for the formation of these particles that do lead to cloud formation. And it's interesting to find that out, because if it's something that humans are producing through their activity, it means there is another thing that we are doing that is influencing the climate.
And the implication is, of course, then that if we can't account for all the cloud formation, then we'd have to change the models that we use for predicting climate change.
That's right, because there are some models that build into them the nucleation and the growth of these particles. And when they get to a certain size, about 100 nanometers, they can start to see clouds. Now, let's just talk very quickly about how these aerosols and the clouds affect climate. The aerosols themselves, they're just tiny particles. They can affect how radiation is from the sun is reflected back out to space. So they can kind of themselves reflect light back out. Also, by forming clouds, Clouds can, you know, reflect light out as well, and so they can influence climate. They can work different ways, but they can influence climate as well.
And so is this news exciting if you're a climate skeptic?
Well, the reason the climate skeptics have jumped on this was really the second part of the study, which looked at what happened when you simulate cosmic rays going through different parts of the atmosphere. And with this cloud chamber, you can simulate really high up and cold and rarefied parts of the atmosphere, and the lower down ones where there is there's a higher temperatures and there's also far more gases to play with. Now, what the study found was that at the higher altitudes in the cold, rarefied parts of the atmosphere, cosmic rays were increasing the nucleation of very small aerosols between 2 and 10-fold. Now, what the experiment doesn't go on to say is didn't look at was whether those particles grew big enough to seed clouds. And they're also in a kind of a part of the atmosphere where you don't really get cloud formation. They're too high up. So you'd normally expect this thing to happen flow down. But the climate skeptics have jumped on it and said, aha, so cosmic rays cause clouds to form, basically, which is a long-standing argument from climate skeptics. And if it does, then you can tie this back into how the sun's activity affects cloud cover and so affects climate change.
So climate change is not anthropogenic.
Yeah, and so there are people out there who are saying this is entirely, you know, that climate change and warming is entirely down to fluctuations in the sun's activity, which affects how many cosmic rays basically reach Earth.
All right, well, let's move on to the next story. Robin, this is your story from last week in The Observer, looking at the, well, quite frankly, horrifying abuse that scientists get for just doing science.
Yes, I mean, quite alarming. This is the condition known as myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, which is common and debilitating and very serious. About 1 in 250 people have it. They end up, many cases, being bedridden, occasionally having to be fed through a tube. And for about 20 years, scientists have tried to, you know, struggle to find the cause. Some people say it's a physiological explanation, it's a virus involved. Other people believe that psychological problems are involved. Most scientists think it's a bit of both. And this is where the trouble starts. There are some extremists who just will not accept that there's any psychological component involved in the condition whatsoever. And any scientist who publishes research either showing that a particular virus is not responsible or that a psychological treatment such as cognitive behavioural therapy can improve the condition, they get it in the neck from these guys. They get death threats. They get the works.
Tell us how the scientific understanding of this condition has changed in the past couple of decades. What were the sort of leads that have sort of fallen away?
Well, in one sense, there hasn't been that much progress in the last 20 years. And time again, a virus has been implicated. And each time, you know, you find particles of viruses that appear to be linked with people who have the condition and not with people who do. But time and time again,
nothing conclusive.
Time and time again, it's found to be basically a laboratory contamination.
There was a recent case of this, wasn't there, with the XMRV virus.
Well,
which was published in a journal, and then was it retracted as the possible cause for this?
Yeah, this is. I mean, one of the people involved in this is Professor Myra McClure. Was able to show that XMRV could not have been a cause, and that it was a case of laboratory contamination. For that, she got deluged with abuse. There was one guy who wrote her an email every day saying, "I'm standing at a bridge and I'm waving as I watch you drown." And he sent that every day for a month. That's the kind of thing that can unnerve you. And it's kind of fairly typical of what this rather small, extremely vocal, the least of the words you should use about these people. They're fanatics, and they're very reminiscent of animal liberation activists.
I mean, there's something interesting also about the abuse that these scientists are getting, because in a sense, if someone suggests that it's a psychological cause, that psychotherapy or psychiatric drugs or any of these sorts of things could help, then the people who are, you know, giving out this abuse will get angry. But then that means that they're thinking that psychological reasons are not good enough reasons. They're not good reasons. I mean,
yes, it's
not scientific enough.
It's indicative of our view of mental illness, I think, of a general malaise in society about, you know, we actually don't think it's a proper illness. And of course it's a proper illness. It's, you know, nobody doubts that really, or should doubt that.
There's an interesting psychology, I think, in the people that you're talking about who target these scientists, because as you mentioned in your piece, there is quite a broad sort of front of attack against some of these scientists, saying that they are suppressing information that this syndrome is caused by viruses, and they're in league with pharmaceutical companies, which makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, because if a pharmaceutical company or a scientist could make a link with a virus and make a pile of money out of it, then they absolutely would. And so it is really interesting what drives people to this. But I think, as what you were just touching on, I think some people see an explanation as being a psychological thing, as a brush off. And I think it's really important that people were just pretty clear that they don't know what's going on here. It could be, it looks pretty open. It could be, you know, it could be viruses involved. There could be all sorts of physical things.
I mean, what
involved.
Is wrong with an explanation that says that a virus triggers it, but it has a different effect in different people? And in some cases, a bit of cognitive behavioral therapy might help some of these people. That seems to me a perfectly reasonable explanation. And why people who suggest it are subject to death threats is a deeply dispiriting kind of reflection on some people that we have at large.
You've catalogued all these people getting this abuse. I mean, is anyone institutionally or in police or anyone actually going to do anything about this? Do you know?
The police take it very seriously. And in the case of a couple of scientists, you know, they have speed dial numbers, and they know one or two people who, you know, they know are making these threats. And if they see them about, they have to phone the police. But that's as far as it's gone at the moment. You know, in a couple of cases, people are checking, you know, having all their mail x-rayed in their laboratories and things like that. Perhaps not quite as far as you had to go when the animal liberation people were at the height of their activities, but still kind of a depressing trend.
Okay, well, thanks for that, Robin. To read that article, you can go to observer.co.uk. Thanks to Robin and Ian Sample there. For more science news every day, go to guardian.co.uk/science.
And now, the Hanford question.
Hi, I'm Dr. Kate Jones from the Zoological Society of London. What I'd really like to know is, how much biodiversity do we need on this planet, and how much can we afford to lose? Because we're losing it at such a rapid rate. And I don't know, and I really think we need to find out exactly how much we can afford to lose without ecosystems collapsing. And the services that we get from ecosystems like pollination, seed dispersal, water regulation, water quality regulation, how much of those services depend on wild nature?
There's a famous tagline to a famous movie about space sounds. What is it? Oh yeah, in space, no one can hear this podcast. Actually, I'm not sure that's right. But what is correct is that there's no sound in space. None at all. Well, not unless you're a bit creative with your frequency spectra. Astrobiologist and author Lewis Dartnell has been trying to make the sounds of space come alive for an event at the National Space Centre as part of their Café Scientifique. He's here in the studio now to take us through some of his creations. First off, Lewis, what were we just hearing there?
What we're listening to there, Alec, was the sounds of the aurora on the planet Saturn. So the aurora on Earth, people at home might have seen, are the northern and southern lights. Are these shimmering curtains of intense colour up in the sky, formed by when particles from outer space, many of them spat out by the sun, are curved along the magnetic field of the Earth and plunge down into the upper atmosphere to excite atoms to give off light there. But as well as being excited to give off light, the aurora give off lots of radio emissions. So you can record these and then play them through a set of speakers, which is what we were listening to just then. Those were the sounds of the northern and southern lights on the planet Saturn rather than Earth.
So Lewis, tell us why you've put these sounds together in the first place.
Well, I'm doing a talk at the National Space Centre called The Sounds of the Cosmos. And the idea I want to get across here is we've all seen stunning imagery and photographs of things in outer space from the Hubble Space Telescope or from the Mars landers. But you can actually explore space with your other senses as well. You can listen to the sounds of outer space. Now, as you said, obviously, space itself is a vacuum and sound waves can't pass through unless there's a material there. So many of these recordings we've got are actually radio waves that can travel through space. And we're now playing through some speakers so that our ears can analyse and listen to the patterns and the eminences coming from these different objects. But there are also some sounds of outer space in a very literal sense. And one of the recordings I'm playing at the National Space Centre is the Song of the Sun, that the vibrations rippling the way across the surface of our star. This is the sound of our local star, the Sun. It's a recording made by the SOHO spacecraft, where it's been monitoring the surface of the Sun as it bounces up and down with all the energy radiating out of the core through the convective zone just beneath the surface of the Sun. So the surface of our star is vibrating like the skin of a drum. And these recordings we've been listening to have been sped up 42,000 times. So these sound waves, these are literal sound waves, have a period of about 5 minutes. And we sped it up so you can hear it within the human auditory range. The second recording is also of our Sun, but it's not this bass note that we're listening to. It's all the other modes of vibration that the surface of our star ripples with, all being overlaid upon each other.
Why is it that scientists actually want to listen to the sounds of the Sun?
There's a whole field of science called helioseismology. It's essentially the study of sun quakes, because you can work out an awful lot of the internal composition and structure of our Sun and of other stars by looking at these vibrations and ripples as they pass over the surface.
You're going to demonstrate quite a lot of sounds in this lecture, but what's your absolute favourite?
Well, my favourite of all of them is a recording that was made by the Cassini spacecraft as it approached Saturn and had to pass through the rings, the majestic rings of this planet, as it dropped into orbit. And the recording we've got here is of the pitter-patter of all the ice crystals that make up these rings hitting against the spacecraft. And this recording sounds almost exactly like the pitter-patter of rain against a car's windscreen. So this is the recording. Close your eyes and imagine you're passing through the rings of Saturn and dropping into orbit. You can hear the intensity of this ice crystal bombardment build up and then fade away again as Cassini passed through the rings and out the other side.
Thanks to Lewis Dartnell there, and for more information on Café Scientifique at the National Space Centre, just go to spacecentre.co.uk. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.